Welcome, everyone, to the Dr. Thibault study. And we are going through Harry Thibault, the collected writings. And we are on page 22 of the book, The Difference Between Submission and Surrender. And this is our third meeting together. And with that, I will turn it over to our leader, Howard. Press star 6, Howard.
I kept playing, hitting hash 6, and I kept wanting my pin, so. Hi.
Good.
I'm back. So, yeah, as Suzanne said, we're starting the second half of that second paper in the book. And Thibault has identified, has talked about surrender as being overcoming this unconscious resistance that the ego puts up. And that he described surrender as a relaxation of that unconscious resistance. So that surrender exists in our unconscious mind. Now he's going to talk about surrender, which he defined as what happens only in the, if you only surrender in your conscious mind, and the unconscious resistance remains. So that's what he's going to talk about next. Oh, I'm sorry. And I wanted to say one other thing is that about two-thirds of the way through, he's going to switch to applying all of this to the therapeutic process, and he's going to switch into total talk to psychiatrist mode, and he's going to try to relate what he's learned in AA to general therapy, and that's it can be a little thick and really doesn't matter that much.
Thank you, and with that, we'll have Terry start the reading.
Hey, my name's Terry, and we're going to start on the difference between submission and surrender. One fact must be kept in mind, namely the need to distinguish between submission and surrender. In submission, an individual accepts reality consciously, but not unconsciously. He or she accepts as a practical fact that he or she cannot at that moment lick reality, but lurking in the unconsciousness is the feeling. There'll come a day which implies no real acceptance and demonstrates conclusively that the struggle is still on. With submission, which is at best is a superficial yielding, tension continues. When an individual surrenders, the ability to accept reality functions on the unconscious level, and there is no residual or battle, relaxation with freedom from strain, and conflict ensues. In fact, it is perfectly possible to ascertain how much acceptance of reality is on the unconscious level by the degree of relaxation that develops. The greater the relaxation, the greater the inacceptance of reality.
Wow. Thank you, Terry. And Stephanie?
Star 6.
We can now be more precise in our definition of an act of surrender. It is not to be viewed as a moment when the unconscious forces of defiance and grandiosity actually cease to function effectively. When that happens, the individual is wide open to reality. He or she can listen and learn without conflict and fighting back. He or she is receptive to life, not antagonistic. The person senses a feeling of relatedness and at-oneness that becomes the source of an inner peace and serenity, the possession of which frees the individual from the compulsion to drink. In other words, an act of surrender is an occasion wherein the individual no longer fights life but accepts it. Having defined an act of surrender as a moment of accepting reality on the unconscious level, it is now possible to define the emotional state of surrender as a state in which there is a persisting capacity to accept reality. In this definition, the capacity to accept reality must not be conceived of in a passive sense, but in the active sense of reality being a place where one can live and function as a person acknowledging one's responsibilities and feeling free to make that reality more livable for oneself and others. There is no sense of must, nor is there any sense of fatalism. With true unconscious surrender, the acceptance of reality means the individual can work in it and with it. The state of surrender is really positive and creative.
Thank you. Bob?
Suzanne, I'm having a little trouble getting my book online, so can you skip me right now?
Sure, I'll read for you.
Thanks.
To sum up, my observations have led me to conclude that an act of surrender is inevitably followed by a state of surrender that is actually the positive state in the conversion picture. Because of the two always being associated, I believe they represent a single phenomenon to which I attach the term surrender reaction. Shall we stop there, or would you like me to read another paragraph, Howard?
Well, I'd like to talk about that stuff, but go ahead with the next paragraph, and we'll do it then.
Okay. Relating the act of surrender to the therapeutic process. Having at last made as clear as I could my use of the term surrender, I must now try to relate that concept to the therapeutic process. While a recognition of the dynamic force of the event has proven enlightening in many directions, it has been particularly helpful in understanding the fluctuations in moods of patients and in certain aspects of therapy. All yours, Howard.
Okay, well, one of the striking things about that is this description of the positive phase. You can listen and learn without conflict, receptive to life, not antagonistic. Senses a feeling of relatedness and that oneness. It's very, spiritual sounding. And, to have that come out of a fairly dry treatment of psychiatric matters is pretty remarkable. So anyway, that just lays out the thesis that, there's a lot of angst. In my experience, people have a lot of worry about whether they've surrendered, especially when they're reading stuff like this and they say, well, did I surrender enough? And I think it's really not that complicated. To the degree that you are surrendered, you're going to get the benefit after, right? So, and we say we have to admit to our innermost selves we are alcoholics, the big book's full of language like, get to express this without reservation. And that's what we shoot for. Sometimes people's circumstances they're just not far enough along down the road and they're all full of angst about whether or not, they've surrendered correctly or deeply enough. And, I think it actually behooves a newcomer or anyone to look at that and say, am I really believing this stuff? But on the other hand, it's like if you're underway, my personality is I keep tending to look and question my motives and question my behavior. It's actually part of my disease. And so I've had to, cut myself some slack on that and not worry about it so much. So that's just a personal note on this. That's all.
This is Suzanne.
Mm-hmm.
So it also brings up that whole idea of multiple surrenders.
Mm.
We surrender more than once, especially if we're working the steps if we're going through the steps on a regular basis, not just like working the steps once.
Mm.
And for me, it takes me to, I'm not sure what the page number is in the big book, but it's in the 80s when Pa comes out of the cellar and he says, nothing wrong here when just the wind blowing when there's been a cyclone. And that to me, really, what I had to do was, yes, I worked the steps the first time around, but then there were a lot of other things that I was having trouble with that I went back and worked the steps again. So there were these repeated surrenders for me, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anybody else like to share?
Hi, Suzanne and Howard and everyone. This is Karen. Awesome stuff. I was thinking about those pages in the ninth and tenth step too, Suzanne. You know, when it says that we have ceased fighting anything and anyone in a true surrender. This one, it's talking about the difference between submission and surrender. I see this in the halls all the time. Submission. We submit to this when we're ordered by the Commonwealth or when we're ordered by our spouses or our children or our workplace, that we have to go in and do this, and we're pacing up and down saying, okay, let's get this done. Nothing about us changes. And you know, we've come off of a prodigious bender or something. But a surrender is when, you know, we take a drink and it doesn't, and it's over, man. It doesn't, there's no relief there anymore. And we say, okay, I can't live like this. Now my only medicine isn't working. What do I have to do? Because I cannot live with this unmanageability. That's how that I'm seeing it in other people, and that's how I saw it in myself. And that's when there's a ceasefire between my mind and body. My mind stops begging my body to do what it can't tolerate. And I call it a ceasefire. When I share about this in meetings, I say that the only way to experience a ceasefire is to overcome a spiritual malady. And so, you know, he doesn't say that stuff in this book, but he knew it. You know, and I know he did when I continued to read Dr. Thibault's work. So when it talks about, you know, once surrendered and the willingness comes to do whatever it takes to not live like I need a drink, then we're open to what's really going on. So I love this part of this reading, so thanks, everyone.
Great comments.
I have another comment if nobody has any other comments. And that is at the end of the last sentence, in when we start off in the difference between submission and surrender, it's the top of page 23, if you're in the book, and it's the last sentence, and it says, with submission, which at best is a superficial yielding, tension continues. And what I really like about this sentence is that it really gives me a specific action to look for between submission and surrender. So if I'm submitting, I still am going to have some kind of angst. If I've had a true surrender, to me that's lifted. It's almost like the way that I experience a psychic change. Something lifts, or even a seventh step with a character defect. Something just kind of automatically changes. And I really like the fact that Dr. Thibault makes it at least very clear to me what that if tension continues, that's what submission is. So thank you.
Yeah, that's a good observation. Of course, you know, in a psychiatric sense, if there's still tension, that's still resistance to therapy, right? So he says just on his face, that means the surrender hasn't occurred.
This is Lee.
Hi, Lee.
So what I was thinking about is I came in and out of AA for 8 years, and there was actually times that I wanted to stop. I would get about 3 months or 4 months, and I would drink again. And so when Howard was first talking about, you know, being surrendered on a superficial level or whatever, on the conscious but not the subconscious. On page 30 in the big book, it talks about we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we were like other people or presently may be has to be smashed. And it was just always that denial in me that somehow I could just make a decision not to drink. And this time, it was completely different. This time, I knew I could drink again. And I don't know how to explain it better than that, but I think that was the real surrender that I'm an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. Because every time I would come back in, they would say, people in AA would say, well, are you done? And I'd say, man, I'm done. And this time, you know, I was standing there and I was broke and I was crying. And this guy asked me, he said, are you done? And I said, I don't know. Hell, I thought I was done before. Mm-hmm. And he said, you might be done. And so I didn't understand it then, but I just had admitted my powerlessness over it. So I think that's the best example I have of that in my own life.
Yeah, that's great. You don't know if you're done or not. That's a breakthrough in honesty, right? You know, you're saying it kind of at a superficial level before, but now you're really looking at it. And like yeah. I said earlier, it's pretty simple, you know, with all these psychiatric, psychological looking at it, which is valuable, it's basically, you know, have you thrown in the towel? And you have or you haven't. And, you know, and it's, everybody I know that stayed sober for a while has had that event, you know, where they were just done, like you said.
Yeah.
And, I know what happened to me. Thing is, you know, I retained, unbeknownst to me, I retained, I got sober first in 1987, and I stayed sober for 10 years, and then, and it went out because I stopped doing the deal and got into a bad marriage, and long story, but what happens is the last time, I just turned 7 years sober, and the last time I was here, last time I came in, and hopefully the last ever in my life, I took drugs, and looking back on it, I realized I had reservations in my mind about drugs. Yeah, I can't drink. I know I can't drink. I know I'll never be able to drink. But, you know, I really got too bad with drugs, you know. I never overdosed, never did, you know. So there was this really sneaky kind of thought in my mind that, you know, when the push came to shove, it showed up, you know. And now I'm done with that one. You know, I know for sure I can't do that. So, and I've just surrendered on so many other levels, too, this time around. It's not even funny. But I'm just getting back to people having angst over this. And, you know, I tell people to do your best. You know, read that. You know, we need to fully concede to our innermost selves that we are alcoholics. And you know, if you decide to quit, you got to do this without mental reservation. That's more about alcoholism. You know, and no thought that you can start it up again later.
Yeah.
But, you know, as a, it's a practical thing. It's, you know, it's head and heart and gut, right? Working together. That's the whole human, third-dimensional human thing, right? There's spirit that sort of arises from all of that or creates all of that or both, whatever. But, you know, it's in my gut, I know I can't go on. That's the surrender he's talking about. You know, it's the giving up of the defiance that says, I can do this anyway, and the grandiosity that says, I'm better, I can do this better than anyone, and both of those things are telling me to not admit it, not give it up, you know, and Tebow saying you abandon that, and that's a true surrender.
Yeah.
The other thing is in that next paragraph after the one that I just read with submission, which at best is a superficial yielding, tension continues, it goes on to really explain what to look for with a surrender. There's no residual of battle, relaxation with freedom from strain and conflict ensues.
Yeah.
And then, in fact, it's perfectly possible to ascertain how much acceptance of reality is on the unconscious level by the degree of relaxation that develops. The greater the relaxation, the greater the inner acceptance of reality. And then in the next paragraph, it goes on to say that when this happens, the individual is wide open to reality. He or she can listen and learn without conflict and fighting back. So there's like no, what I take that to be is there's no pushback, especially when I'm working with a sponsee. And I really like this part that he or she is receptive to life, not antagonistic. And for me, it's like I'm willing to be challenged. I'm willing to take that risk. And learn and be open to comments, to be open to, more open to criticism that I have been in the past. So one thing that I just read, though, that I do find, let's see, why do you think he wrote, there is no residual battle, relaxation with freedom, from strain and conflict ensues.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of, that from strain and conflict ensues kind of puzzles me why he...
Well, he's describing the pink cloud, basically.
Yeah.
You
okay,
stop fighting. Yeah, where's the quote again?
It's on 23, and it's the...
Yeah. There's no residual of battle, relaxation with freedom to restrain. And what, basically, he's saying that if someone has surrendered, they're not battling anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then what comes after giving up the battle is relaxation, and you're not as strained or in conflict as much. Basically, you know, that's the description of someone accepting reality and feeling better because they're more in tune now with reality.
Thank you. Thanks for explaining that part to me. Anybody else?
Well, you know, in the big book, it tells us that alcohol beats us into reasonableness, right?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what part of what this is saying, that we finally surrender when we've just been beat up?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, so we'll move on. Karen, would you like to?
Certainly.
The following
patient's problem took on meaning for me when I grasped the fact that he had experienced an act of surrender at the time he attended his first AA meeting. A man in his middle 30s, he tells his story this way. I was licked. I'd tried everything and nothing had worked. My wife was packing to leave me. My job was going to blow up in my face. I was desperate when I went to my first AA meeting. When I got there, something happened. I don't know to this day, a year later, what it was, but I took a look at the men and women there, and I knew they had something I needed. So I said to myself, I'll listen to what they have to tell me. From that time on, things have been different. I go to meetings, work with other drunks, and study all I can about alcoholism. I know I'm an alcoholic, and I never let that fact escape me. Do you want me to do the top paragraph?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you stop and review this man's account, you will note the statement, I'll listen to what they have to tell me. in that comment to himself, the patient initiated his act of surrender.
Howard, would you like to continue on, or would you like to share?
Well, I'd just like to say that the next couple of paragraphs are pretty good. I mean, we're differing acts of surrender. He gets real technical, but this next stuff talks about the resurgence. Whoops. Okay, where did I just... There we go. I lost my place. And say there was no lip service, right? Yeah.
Right.
There was no lip service in his willingness to listen. He really wanted help. There was no defiance or grandiosity available at the moment to dilute his listening. He was accepting, without reservation or conflict, the reality of his condition and the need for help. And significantly enough, at this point, he goes on to say, from that time on, things have been different. Subsequent events clearly indicate that this man did experience the typical change I've been calling conversion. And from that time on, things were different. His wife, commenting on this change, said feelingly, "It's the most remarkable thing I ever could imagine. The only trouble is that I still have to keep my fingers crossed because it doesn't make any sense to me." So yeah, it takes a while to rebuild trust. The patient, however, consulted me because he didn't like the way things were going. By that, he meant that he was finding himself cranky at home and irritable in business. Signs that his AA experience had taught him were ominous. When I asked him why he gave up drinking, he replied that he had made his mind to quit, and so he did, although he had to admit that AA was helpful. A little surprised at this simple assertion and doubting it somewhat, I plied him with further questions and got the real story, which showed to me that he had had a typical surrender experience, followed by a typical positive aftermath, but I also saw that the change did not last, and after several months in which the patient had lived in a state of surrender, he slowly reverted to his former attitudes and ways of feeling. In other words, the surrender reaction did not fix itself into his personality and thus allowed the return of his previous state of mind. And this is one of the big takeaways from Thiebaud, is the resurgence of the ego. And something that we all know from experience, you know, people slipping, but also, you know, moving away from the practice and feeling like life hasn't changed much, even though you're not drinking, you know, can all be related to that.
Thanks. Anybody else want to share? Bob, would you like to continue differing acts of surrender?
Hi, Bob, sure. The fact of the surrender reaction is in itself an interesting study. With some, the surrender experience is the start of genuine growth and maturation. With others, the surrender phase is the only one ever reached, so that they never lose the need to attend meetings and to follow the program assiduously, apparently relying on the constant reminders in their daily existence to supply the necessary impetus to the surrender feeling, at least insofar as alcohol is concerned. For a few, there seems to occur a phenomenon of what might be called selective surrender. After the effects of the initial surrender experience have worn away, the individual returns to pretty much the same person he or she was before, except for the fact that the person doesn't drink. His surrender is not to life as a person, but to alcohol as an alcoholic. Many other differing aftermaths undoubtedly occur, but a study of any or all of them would, I am sure, disclose the same basic fact. The surrender experience is followed by a phase of positive thinking and feeling that undergoes various vicissitudes before it becomes established in some form or other in the psyche, or it is lost completely, becoming merely a memory and a mirage. You want me to go on?
Vicissitudes means trouble. Troubles.
Well, does anybody want to comment on that before Bob goes on?
Yeah, I think with some, the surrender experience is the start of genuine growth and maturation. With others, the surrender phase is the only one ever reached, so that they never lose the need to attend meetings and follow the program assiduously. I feel like that's a misunderstanding of someone who's not actually an alcoholic. That, you know, and he's looking at AA and sees that there are people that attend over and over, and he sees people whose lives have turned around and they're not going to meetings. So he's seeing there's those two classes of people. As a psychiatrist, he's looking for, the goal of psychiatry is to take a patient from, and bring them into good adjustment with the rest of the world. And once you do that, the idea is that they then live in the world, you know, on their own. And so he sees this constant going to meetings as a weakness. It sounds like it, and there's sort of an implication there. At least that's what I get out of it. So I just think that's somewhat of a misunderstanding on his part.
I have a question for you. Do you think when he's saying again, you know, the surrender experience is followed by a phase of positive feeling, ... do you think he's also talking about, when he's talking about the phase of positive thinking, once again, that's the pink cloud?
I think so. So pink cloud is where you feel really cool about what you're doing. Suddenly you've got, you know, I broke through in a new way of thinking, right? My surrender opened up my eyes to reality. And I was full of joy because of seeing things more clearly. I think that's sort of the emotion that goes along with it that we call the pink cloud. But he's looking at the therapeutic process, and what happens to his patients is when they experience that, they stop fighting and they can move forward in therapy. So I think that's his main view of it. And from program point of view, that's, you know, consistent. Right, it's now we go move on with the steps. So I've used them interchangeably, and they really are. I mean, you know, but you can lose the pink cloud and still be committed and still move on,
right?
As all of us do, so or must.
But I think even without the pink cloud, there can still be a more positive way of looking at life. Even if you're not, like, just kind of stuck on that pink cloud. At least that's kind of been my experience more. It's, you know, I have more hope.
That was what, that sums up how I felt, and that made me happy. Mm-hmm. So I was on a pink cloud behind that fact that there was actually hope in my life. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I agree with you. It's like everybody's different. Some go through the pink cloud, some don't. And it can be sort of distracting, too. You got to move on. And I think he says later here that you've got to move on and actually adjust to reality. In fact, I think it's coming right up. But,
does anybody else want to share on that before we have Bob go on?
You know, in this paragraph, this is Karen, he says, his surrender is not to life as a person, but to alcohol as an alcoholic. And, you know, we learn through this work that we do that we have to surrender, like, on that soul level. Because if I'm surrendering to alcohol as an alcoholic, boy, I found a lot of other ways to be sick for 20 years. You know, and so I think that ties into the last one that it says, you know, before it becomes established in some form or other in the psyche, or it is lost completely, becoming merely a memory or a mirage. And that's what it's like when it's like surrendering to alcohol is superficial for us. I mean, that's what I get out of this paragraph the most. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And he talks about the people that just go on and they're the same person with the same character before and after. The only thing that's changed is they've stopped drinking. And you also see people revert to old bad characters. The rest of the program is a spiritual journey that results in an amendment of your character, and you know, into a new person, you know. And so the surrender can stop, you know, just the drinking is what I'm saying.
Anybody else want to share? Okay, so Bob, we'll have you continue with the next paragraph.
Sure. Recognizing the surrender reaction. From the standpoint of therapy, recognition of the surrender reaction throws a challenging light upon many clinical phenomena that are generally held to be of significance in the process of getting better. For instance, in catharsis, it is not what is revealed, but the act of surrender that preceded and permitted the revealing to come to light. That, in my opinion, produces the characteristic afterglow of positive feeling. It also explains its temporary effect, just as with the conversion experience of the alcoholic. Again, the frequent, unexpected lifts derived from seemingly ordinary first interviews, while they may be considered transference phenomena, seem to me more in the nature of surrender reactions based upon the fact that the client found the interview palatable and the client made a decision to continue, which by implication means surrender to the psychiatrist. The very decision to come to a psychiatrist through its surrender significance often has an ameliorating influence and certainly accounts for the remark of a patient who once said, "Once I rang your doorbell, I felt 75% better." The phenomenon of release, which makes people realize that in losing their lives they are finding them, becomes explicable if one sees that the surrender that preceded the sense of release stills the inner fight and hostility, thus permitting the spontaneous creative elements of the inner self outlet for expression.
Thank you. Would anybody like to share?
Yeah, so this is what I was talking about. He's gone into full psychiatrist mode here, and he's trying to convince his colleagues that what he has observed about surrender in alcoholics is really underlies a lot of the things that psychiatrists see in their patients. So there's a lot of vocabulary here. In catharsis is the process of releasing emotions that are suppressed or they're bound up, and letting them go and thereby feeling better, getting better. So that's catharsis, and it's something that was well known in therapy, and he's likening that to the surrender reaction in alcoholics. So and then transference is a technical term, which means that basically the patient's feelings shift to the therapist. So this is all and basically saying that that what he's calling surrender reaction is where people get a positive change in his therapy and are surrendering to him. And that's, you know, that doesn't work for me. I mean, it may be true in terms of a psychotherapy, right? But this is, I don't think this is aimed at us. I think this is aimed at his colleagues, and it's, and I'm not sure what I can get a value out of that for our discussion. I don't know if anybody sees something in there that we could, it's just that he's talking about how what he's been describing can work in a therapeutic setting. And in that case, it's more in touch with the formal process of psychotherapy, which he's talking about with his colleagues. So he's going very technical on us and saying some things that, frankly, I don't agree with very much. But so that's all.
So I just want to remind everybody, press *6 after you read, or just be sure that you're muted if you're not speaking. Okay. Anybody else want to share?
Bob, alcoholic.
Go ahead, Bob.
Hey, Susan. So what I've been thinking about while reading this was the act of surrender and the state of surrender. For me, in my recovery, that was doing the third step and really turning my care of my will and my life over to the care of God. When I did that, that was the final surrender for me, you know, first surrender to come in, first surrender to agree to well, being backed into a corner, not having any way not to go to AA and recovery. But it was that really doing that third step when the weight came off my shoulders, so to speak, and I did surrender to the fact that if I don't try to run the world, control the world, and have the world centered around me, I start to feel better. I get that cathartic state of just like there's a total wit, like the pressure's not on me anymore. I don't have to worry about anything, and just, you know, what live out what God's plan is. And in order to stay in that state, I have to, you know, do the things I need to do every day to remind myself that that's the way it is with the prayer. It was a total change in my life that, and I went to therapy a number of times and I never got that there. And I think, I don't know if he talks about it later, but what seems to be lacking in this discussion is I agree that, you know, the first time you go to a therapist, as scared as you might be, like you're scared coming into an AA meeting for the first time, when you do it, you get that feeling better, like where he says the guy felt 75% better. But for me, I never got all the way better. And one of the key reasons, I think, was not being honest. Because for me to get better, I had to be honest. And I know for a fact, I will confess, that when I was going to various therapists, I wasn't honest. And I remember leaving those sessions all the time and going back to my life, which, you know, for 45 minutes I could talk about something about and maybe feel a little different about it, but it didn't last. And nothing changed because I wasn't honest and I didn't surrender to anything. So it was definitely a big difference in when I did that surrender in AA. That's it.
Thank you.
Yeah, the focus on honesty in AA and the fact that we're dealing with a spiritual process helped me to come to honesty about myself, because I'm not doing this simply for me. It's, you know, I'm getting this ego reduction and I'm trying to follow a path. You know, I turn my will and my life over to God, and that allowed me to be honest. And I wasn't so honest with the therapists, you know, and I intended to focus on all the things I thought were wrong with the world, too. But it's in the book there, you know, he says, rarely have we been honest with these helpful people, you know. I think that paragraph is talking about therapeutic process, which isn't what goes on in AA. He's trying to relate what to my mind is good information about the personality and the ego resistance and all of that stuff. But I kind of leaves me cold when he tries to apply it to the broader strokes of psychiatry.
See, also in psychiatry and psychology, like, it never felt like the therapist was offering a solution like the recovery process, like the 12-step process does.
Good point.
I was supposed to talk my way through it and get to some better place, and, you know, there was no hope of that. I mean, looking back, I know there's no hope of that now. If you're not honest, and B, if I couldn't see the light myself, you know, where were they taking me? I felt like they weren't taking me anywhere.
That's a good point. Anybody else want to share, or we'll move on? Karen, will you continue with resistance?
Sure will. Resistance. It is in the area of resistance, however, that an understanding of the surrender reaction sheds the greatest light on the therapeutic process. Regularly, therapy goes ahead by fits and starts. For a while, there is a period of resistance that is worked through, permitting progress, insight, and awareness of the emotional interplays in the unconscious life. Then another point of resistance is encountered, and again, it must be ferreted out and dissolved before further constructive steps may be taken. Meeting resistance and working it through are the everyday tasks of therapy and familiar to you all. Breaking through resistance. Where before the patient has been in full resistance, bucking treatment, difficult to manage, getting nowhere, suddenly there is a marked change, almost like the sun bursting through the clouds, bringing everything into focus and making what was once a confused jumble take on form, significance, and meaning. For the time being, the resistances have disappeared and the treatment proceeds apace.
Shall we continue on, or are there any comments?
I just didn't want to do a quick comment. At this point, he's not talking about alcoholics. He's talking about patients generally.
Great. Terry, would you like to read the next paragraph, and then we'll stop at conclusion?
Sure. We have been accustomed to saying that the patient has a flash of insight and understanding that has brought clarification and great awareness to his or her individual emotional makeup. Actually, if you examine the state of mind that breaks through when the resistance melts, you will find it strikingly parallel to the positive state of mind an individual may have after conversion experience. In fact, the parallel is so striking that I am more and more becoming convinced that the two are identical. In other words, I now believe that the giving up of the resistance during treatment is in reality an act of surrender that typically, as in the conversion experience, is followed by a positive state of mind where elements of resistance are no longer present. This giving in may be sudden, causing the patient to enter the positive phase so rapidly as to constitute a sudden turnover with dramatic results. Generally, as in the conversion change, the change is slower, but the alteration is exactly the same direction.
Any comments?
Talk to him.
He's just relating the act of surrender to the therapeutic process is the name of the paper, you know. So what he's saying is that this thing that was known to psychiatrists, the resistance, the overcoming of resistance, which is, as he says, is the normal work that you do as a therapist, that he has a new explanation for it, which he's looking at the surrender reaction, the act of surrender and the state of surrender. And he's seen it in alcoholics, given it, form in his mind what he thinks it is, and he says, well, that looks like all this other stuff in psychiatry, so psychology.
Anybody else? So, Terry, we'll have you continue with another paragraph.
Okay. Conclusion. No one recognizes more than I do the sweeping nature of any such observation. No one is more aware than I am of the need to sustain these observations with clinical material. Someday I may be able to support more conclusively my present hypothesis, thank you, with case material. I can point out, however, that the positive aftermath of the so-called successful interpretation is no more lasting than the positive phase of the so-called conversion experience. They are both temporary. They are both slowly supplanted by a new crop of resistance of negative feelings. Also, they both require further change in the unconscious mind before the act of surrender becomes a settled state of surrender in which defiance and grandiosity no longer raises havoc with adjustment, serenity, and the capacity to function as a human being. Let me stop there. That's the next paragraph.
Yeah, why don't we stop there? And Howard, any comments or anybody else?
Well, it's just more of the same. It's relating to saying the two events are very similar. He's talking to his colleagues. I don't feel like this has much application to my life. And just doesn't speak to me as well as a lot of other stuff in Thibault does.
Thank you. Stephanie, would you like to continue on?
You want me to continue to read?
Yes, please.
To recapitulate?
To recapitulate, my studies of the conversion experience have led me to see that it is the act of surrender that initiates the switch from negative to positive behavior. It occurs when the unconscious defiance and grandiosity are for the time being rendered completely powerless by force of circumstance or reality. The act of surrender and the change that follows are inseparable, since it is safe to assume that if there is no change, there has been no surrender. The positive phase is really a state of surrender that follows the act of surrender. In several places, as in catharsis, the so-called improvement or feeling better is actually a state of surrender induced by an act of surrender. The state of surrender, if maintained, supplies an emotional tone to all thinking and feeling that does ensure healthy adjustment. I have tried in this paper to establish the fact that there is such a psychic event as surrender, and that once the fact is appreciated in all its ramifications, it is illuminating clinically and provides a basis for understanding much that goes on in the therapeutic process.
Thank you. Anybody want to share on that or summarize anything that may have come to them from reading this chapter?
Yeah, I do. This is Stephanie. I think just like what Howard was saying, it seems that at least this part of his writing, that the audience is really his colleagues, and it seems to me, and I don't know, but it seems like he's trying to do the really difficult job of translating his experience and working with alcoholism and translating it so that the psychiatric community can understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because the transformation is largely spiritual, it just seems like it's a really tough thing to do. You know, to just try to find that clinical language and then, you know, try to like, it seems like he's just really trying to support and have like use data based on his experience as a clinician to try to get his colleagues to really understand the magic of what happens in recovery. And I, you know, it's a tough job. It's a really, really tough job, I think. That's it.
Good comment. I don't know if Tebow fully appreciates the magic of the of AA or not. He's taking a very rationalistic view, and you know he's a scientist. That's what they do. And he talks about spiritual matters later, but he doesn't emphasize them. And he's not talking about how to maintain things, how to stay surrendered. He's got no feeling or is paying no attention to the rest of the program where we have a transformation, a personality transformation, and ultimately a full-blown spiritual experience. So, yeah, I think that's one thing you have to understand about him in order to get what is of value out of that, which is, the analytical look at the character and the psychology of the alcoholic. And, knowledge is doesn't work to keep us sober, but this is a look at how this thing works in my brain, how it works in my mind psychologically. And for me, it was really, really valuable to realize, and his emphasis on ego was something, in the big book, they only mentioned ego a few times, but in the 12x12, it's all over, and the difference is that Bill's been talking to Tebow a lot. And so he really got the idea of ego, and it worked, right, with AA, right? I'm not saying that Bill suddenly decided that ego was a new idea. It wasn't a new idea, but he adopted Tebow's language. So, you know, it's good for this, and it's also good for me to, like, relate, as we have been doing, as you have been doing, and I've been learning from you, and I'm appreciative of your comments, is, you know, relating that psychological activity to the spiritual change. You know, and that's matter that is outside the reading, but that we all have experience with. So that's one of the most valuable things I'm finding about this whole process. So.
Anybody else? So if there are no other comments, and since we've come to the end of the chapter and our time is almost up, I'll ask again if anybody has any final comments.
Hi, this is Karen. Thanks, everyone, for your input. This has been a great call tonight. I'm kind of like getting this feeling from what we just read tonight that, you know, reading this, we can forget sometimes that he's talking to colleagues and not to some of us. And that I think that I get the idea from, you know, that paragraph that Howard was talking about, that everything he's saying in there about transference and stuff, that happens to us at meetings. I mean, you know, I see it in people, and I felt it in myself. The first meeting that I went to when I came back after relapsing after 20 years, I experienced it immediately that I just wanted to be there, and that's where I felt safe, and that's where mm-hmm. I felt connected for the first time in my life. You know, seriously, like really connected. So I kind of feel like he was describing that in there, and that he's like, in a way, you know, he is a scientist, and it is very clinical and very scientific, all of this. But there's this underlying tone of, this is what happens to these people when they're together. That's just what I got out of it. Thanks.
Interesting perspective. Yeah, well, I looked up transference, and it's very complicated. The term in psychiatry is one, but it's a very complicated definition of basically taking thoughts and feelings from one area and shifting them to somewhere else. So it's like, so what you're describing is going into the meeting is that you're, I guess from my experience, you know, I had all these feelings of separation from and alienation and just loneliness. I didn't feel like I belonged anywhere, and suddenly found some place where I belong. So that really gave me an emotional commitment to the place. So yeah, I guess that probably falls into the heading of transference. Yeah. So I mean, we have our experience, right? You know, and can fill in the blanks. For me, I don't think I can tell whether Tebow is actually aware of that stuff when he's talking to his colleagues. I think it's a mystery to me whether he is or not. I don't want to give it away, but later there's a paper in here which it's a transcription of a talk he gave to an AA convention that is not to his colleagues, and it sums up most of this stuff, and it's really a tremendous thing. It's later in the book. And there he does talk about spirituality. So maybe it's just audience dependent. And it's certainly true that he's talking to his colleagues here and being very technical and trying to get them to understand things that they're resistant to. And you'll see in the next paper that they're quite resistant to the idea of surrender, seeing it as a weakness.
Well, thank you. Anybody else have a final comment? So with that, would you like to all say the Serenity Prayer together?
Okay.
God,
Serenity.
I will stop the recording.
Well, thank you, everybody. That was great.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Look forward to next week.
Yeah.
Good night, all.
Good night, Kim.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Take care. Good night.
End it or not. So I think what we're going to need to do tonight is to just all hang up, and we can call back in if you'd like to have any further discussion. I'm not exactly sure. It will stop the conference when we all hang up. Otherwise, if you want to continue to talk, it may also still be recording.